it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Welcome, dear listener, to Fear from the Heartland. I'm your host, Paul J. McSorley. Set aside some moments now and take an adventurous ride on a journey into the psyche of some talented writers. They will dig into your being and titillate you. Oh, I love that word, titillate. While the stories may not all take place in the Heartland, I am delivering them to you from the Heartland. My intention is to strike fear and confusion into the mind, soul, and yes, the heart. This is Fear from the Heartland. Hello, Heartlanders, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 20 of Fear from the Heartland. I'm your host, Paul J. McSorley. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy ad-free versions of this and all our other episodes, as well as hundreds of tales from our audio archives dating back to 2012, visit simplyscarypodcasts.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today to get instant access from our friends at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Thank you for your support. So, I am standing around a campfire not too awfully long ago with some friends, and a comment was made, actually a question. Where were you when the lights went out? My buddy Sweeney doesn't miss a beat, and in his best deadpan voice, silhouetted in the dark by the aforementioned fire, he spoke a very simple answer. In the dark. Now, many of you may not give a rat's behind by that answer, but for some reason, I thought it uproariously funny. I guffawed and told him as much. It got me thinking, how would you, dear listener, answer the question, where were you when the lights went out? Shoot me your answer in the comments section. I may just include some of them in a future opening segment. Two dandies for you tonight by the likes of two talented authors, Heath Paff and Hank Belbin. Let's get after it. Brother Vance has a calling, literally. He can see into the future. A voice speaks to him. A cult figurehead, Father Icarus, takes Vance under his tutelage to help lead his flock. Vance, over time, realizes Father Icarus has evil intentions. Vance decides the voice speaking to him is the only direction he needs, until it becomes way too uncanny, man. And now, for your indulgence, The Voice by Heath Paff. Brother Vance, tell us the latest prophecy. Surely you have seen more by now. The man before me was a wiry, tall creature with hair that seemed to be trying to run from the center of his head as though it might escape from some impending disaster. His eyes were a shade of blue that made ice seem warm, and there was a dullness to his appraisal that told me his thoughts were simple and dark. He dressed in black slacks and a black shirt that showed off his clerical collar, lest anyone forget that he was an ordained priest. He called himself Father Icarus, for he intended to lead us all into the light. Perhaps there had been a time when he was a good man, but that time was gone before I knew him, burned away by his continued attempts to climb into the sun. All that was left was obsession and a steadfast belief that he was in possession of the key to true salvation. He believed I was to be that key, but the truth was that there was no salvation to find. I saw the future. More precisely, the future was spoken to me, whispered in my ear at night while I tried to sleep. The voice of prophecy was like the tone of an old dial phone played across the bones of a washboard made of glass reeds. It rattled the teeth in my skull and stuck like hooks in my cavities, sending sparks of hot wire pain directly into my brain. I wanted to beg it not to speak to me, but it seemed to find pleasure in my pleas, and I had long since given up hope of relief. This was the voice of salvation that Father Icarus so believed in. This was the gift they all sought from me, though they hardly understood that it was no gift at all. At first, I had stolen positive things from these nightly horrors. I could turn my back to the blackness of the world if only I could find the silver lining at its edge. And not everything whispered into my ear was poison. I prophesied storms and was always right. I told my peers where to plant their farms to avoid terrible floods. I predicted births down to the exact hour and prophesized the rise and fall of political figures. Father Icarus always loved to hear my predictions, and none more so than the one he considered the true sign of my power. I pulled from the ether the winning numbers of the largest lottery in our state's history, and the church reaped the benefits of my prediction. Surely then, my powers were good and just? Surely the source of such great fortune couldn't be evil? The things I kept to myself were the things that showed the true nature of the voice. I told no one about the rise of dark cults across the world. I shared no secrets about the babies born with black eyes and razor teeth that cut their own way from the womb. I wouldn't have known where to start talking about the doorways opening to strange places that let stranger things crawl into our universe. How could I begin to explain that other groups, just like ours, were popping up all over the world, and that their good intentions were turning into twisted nightmares? The flock didn't know that I had heard these things as well. They didn't know that the voice of prophecy had told me that the world was ending and that a time of suffering without end was coming. I had been quiet for days, unable to see light in the darkness of my nightly horrors. The worst of the prophecies were all that remained, repeated nightly like a madman's favorite album. Father Icarus was growing impatient. After all, my lack of prophecy made him look bad. It made his flock begin to doubt, or so he claimed. The truth was that the father's flock had already accepted him as a newly born savior. I had no idea what he would have to do to chase them away, but it wouldn't be as easy as not giving them a new prophecy for a few days. "Surely the Lord has given you another premonition, son," he pressed me. He had been pushing me for days, and so in anger, I gave him what he wanted. "What gift does he have for us true believers?" His nagging had grown to be too much. If it was prophecy he wanted, then it was prophecy I would give him. "A great darkness is coming, and it is hungry and eternal. The end of all things to have begun. You will know it's coming by the messenger, a man who speaks for the unspeakable. He will herald the time of madness." The words were etched into my brain, and repeating them was easy. Father Icarus's expression faltered, darkened. I thought for a moment that he was going to yell, rant, or rave at me and demand I give him something less dark. But then he smiled. His expression was like the breaking of a storm, but the light that shone through the dark wasn't a pleasant one. There was no hope in this silver lining. "I'm not lying," I said cautiously. "I know you're not, my boy." He seemed honestly pleased, and this I found even more disturbing. "This is the kind of prophecy that we've been waiting for since you were first discovered. Can't you see our congregation has lived through the times of light? But what really draws people together is tragedy, hardship. These tribulations that you predict, they are a divine test. We will only grow stronger together, brother." I opened my mouth to protest, but the fervor in the man's eyes was enough to tell me that he wasn't going to listen. Not really. I slipped away as he began his preparations for the end times. I needed to leave this place behind. I'd yet to get a premonition that directly related to Father Icarus and his followers, but I could sense the change in atmosphere. Something bad was coming, and the longer I stayed where I was, the closer it became. The real problem was finding any place that was safe. Where would I go? There are other worlds beyond this one. You only need a key. The voice crackled into my skull, and I stumbled mid-step, barely catching myself on a nearby railing. What key? I was talking to myself, but there was no one around to hear me. Go forth, and I will lead you. This world is already dead, but you can travel to others. Find the key. Steal the van.
I can't just steal the van. People will notice. They'll come looking for me.
The words, with their sudden direction, were making my heart beat fast in my chest. Normally, there were no directions. Normally, there was only descriptions of things that were happening or going to happen. This time, the voice seemed to be actually talking directly to me, and I didn't appreciate its notice. Steal the van, Brother Vance. Escape the darkness. Minutes later, I was in the driver's seat of the compound's van. It was a new vehicle, one purchased with the lottery winnings, but it was still a large van, and so it wasn't exactly meant for fast, stealthy escapes. I had never driven it myself. In fact, I'd only driven a few times in my life, and it had been a much smaller car. I caught myself trying to look in every direction at once and forced my eyes to focus on the task before me. The morning was still dark. No one would be out to check on the van. I reached up and flipped down the visor. The key fell down in front of me and I picked it up. It was so easy. Surely if they cared that much about the van, they would have made more of an effort of keeping the keys in a safe place. It was pretty much a sign. Telling myself this allowed me to build enough nerve to put the keys in the ignition and turn the car on. The engine roared to life, filling the air with what seemed like far too much sound. I was committed at that point. There was no going back now that my escape vehicle was running. The door to the compound slammed open, and someone stepped out into the early morning dark.
"Who's in there?"
a voice yelled. I shifted the van into reverse and slammed on the gas pedal. The vehicle responded with much more enthusiasm than I expected, and a moment later I was tearing my way down the dirt road that led away from the place that I had spent most of my youth. I was finally going to be free. The odds were good that they would come looking for me before long, but they'd be hesitant to use the police. Not all of the things that happened in Paradise City were entirely legal, though Father Icarus assured us that they were legal in the eyes of God, which I took to mean that they were legal in the eyes of Father Icarus, and that would have to be good enough. Still, it was several hours before I stopped checking the rearview mirror every few seconds for an indication that I was being followed. Freedom, however, was to be short-lived. It was only a few moments after I had stopped checking the mirrors that the voice spoke to me again. Left, Vance. It was a simple direction, and I had no plan as to where I would go next, so the direction of the voice was as good as any. Still, listening to it made me feel like I'd given up one abusive overlord for another. Father Icarus was an evil man, and it could be hard to tell at first, but the voice that spoke the prophecies into my head wasn't evil. Evil wasn't a word that could be applied to the kind of darkness the voice represented. If chaos was a natural energy, then that is what the voice would represent. But even knowing that, I followed the directions it gave me. It was either that or be truly alone. And I feared being alone most of all. We drove far off of the main roads until we were on dirt paths climbing heavily wooded hills. At times, things became so bad I wasn't sure that the van would pull through. But it always managed. We traveled for more than 5 hours, but finally we came to the place the voice was leading us. I drove past a heavy steel gate that had been left open. The booth where a guard should have been stationed was empty, the glass broken and the door swinging wide. It was a clear sign that whoever had left this place behind had done so in a hurry. What was this place anyway? It looked like some kind of military installation. I parked my car on the inside of the abandoned gate and walked up to a door cut into the side of the hill. I had seen enough bunkers on television to know what one looked like, and this place was a bunker. The doors were 3 feet thick and sealed by massive turning wheels. Well, they weren't sealed now. The double door was hanging open, a cement tunnel crawling away from the entrance and deeper into the hill. A single line of fluorescent bulbs lit the path.
Where am I? I asked, not entirely certain what kind of answer I expected to get. This is a place where dangerous things have been kept, but no longer. The key that you need is inside. Follow my directions closely. Going the wrong way here means that you will die a horrible death.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
That was enough warning to keep me carefully on the path the voice wanted me to follow, even if the logical part of my thoughts were telling me that just getting away from here was the best thing I could do for my hopes at longevity. Going down into this bunker didn't feel like a good idea. Still, the voice had led me this far, and now I felt as though I was committed to the path it was leading me down. I followed the hallway, ignoring the branches and other directions, until I reached a set of stairs that took me down further into the facility. There were security doors, but they'd all been left open, some clearly intentionally braced open so they wouldn't shut. It looked like a case of sabotage. I turned a corner on the voice's recommendation and heard the sound of distant screams bouncing down the tunnel in my direction. This caused me to hesitate mid-step. Don't slow down if you want to live. Your time is limited. The chill this sent down my back got me moving again quickly. I walked past doors that looked like they'd been pulled from the set of an insane asylum movie. Heavy metal structures with a slot at the top where someone could peer inside. Most of these doors were still shut, but a few of them were open. The voice urged me not to stop and look into the rooms beyond, and so I kept moving. Stop, it finally said, and I turned to an open door on my right side. It's in there. Go retrieve the key. I nodded and walked towards the door. It was already partially ajar, and a part of me wondered if there would be anything left in the room at all. Why was a key locked away in a facility like this anyway? I pushed the handle on the door and it swung open. Inside, the room was barren except for a pedestal in the very center. Atop the pedestal sat a small black sack. Or perhaps it was brown, and it was actually quite large. The more I looked at the bag, the less certain I was of anything about it. It seemed to shift as I turned my head, as though I wasn't seeing all of it at once and I couldn't make my eyes bring it into focus. Is the key in the bag? I asked. You will take the bag, put it in your pocket, and we will leave the same way we came, but faster. So the key is in the bag? I asked again, stepping forward towards the bag, even though doing so made my stomach flop as though I was getting motion sick. You are not to open the bag. Just put it into your pocket and leave. Time is running out, Brother Vance. As if to emphasize the voice's words, an unearthly roar echoed down the corridor, cascading off the walls as though searching for the next victim of whatever horror had summoned the sound. I sprang forward on legs that suddenly wanted to shake and grab the bag, shoving it down into my pocket even as a feeling of utter revulsion swept through me, though the revulsion was quickly followed by a strong curiosity. It was an insidious thing, this curiosity, nettling at the back of my mind in an insistent way. It kept asking me if I really wanted to carry a bag whose contents I didn't know. Wouldn't it be better just to give it a single look to make sure it was safe? A quick peek into the bag couldn't hurt. Fortunately for the time being, I had a far more pressing task to pursue, and that was my escape from this awful place. I ran back through the halls as fast as my legs would take me, and I would have sworn that something terrible was in pursuit. I could feel it at my back, its presence so pressing that I refused to even glance over my shoulder. I knew that if I chanced a single look back, I would be snagged by my pursuer and dragged back into the dark of the tunnels to become just another screaming voice. Somehow I made it back to the van. As I was finally forced to look back the way I'd just come, all I saw was an empty doorway. Whatever phantom had chased me through the halls had gone back into the depths, or perhaps it escaped into the world. Either way, I was free to continue my own exodus. I threw the van into reverse and escaped from that place as fast as the little people mover would take me. It didn't feel fast enough. The pall of that nightmare place seemed to stretch far beyond its walls. In fact, even as I rejoined the highway, I could still feel its cold touch upon my skin. This was my second escape of the day, and some part of me knew it was the more dangerous of the two by far. The strange pull of the object in my pocket was just another aspect of that. It clung to my curiosity like a hook caught the gut of an overeager fish. "The end of this place is upon us," the voice of Havoc rang through my head. "Then how do we escape it?" I asked, more afraid than I'd ever been before. I didn't want to live in a world that felt as alien as this one now did. "I have the key. How do I get out now?"
"The door."
The words slipped into my consciousness, bringing them images of an old wood door set in the frame of buildings in what looked like a city alley. If there was something special about the door, I couldn't decipher the fact with just the short vision granted to me, but I knew I wouldn't have to either. The voice was still guiding me, and now I knew where we were going. We traveled on through the night and into the next day. I hadn't slept, and every minute of driving was an agony, a personal fight to stay awake and aware. Before I even knew it, we were pulling off of the interstate and winding our way into the depths of the city. The buildings rose like spires around us, and the angry scream of the traffic kept me alert for this last leg of my journey. Even in this place that was so alien to me, I could sense the change in the world. Shadows moved where they shouldn't, and tempers flared at even the smallest offenses. A man crossing the street against the light was accosted by an angry driver who dragged him to the ground and began beating him savagely as a crowd gathered and cheered him on. I passed a small store where the clerk had drawn a weapon on a kid he had caught stealing a can of soda. Thankfully, I was well past the scene when I heard the telltale bark of weapon fire. A couple caught in a small argument tumbled across the ground, fists flying and hateful words drowning out the laughter of those who had come to watch it all unfold. People were exploding with hate and rage. I moved through them like a man wading into a swift river. I could feel the torrent of madness washing around me, but I kept moving forward. Escape was nearly at hand. I followed the guidance of the voice down a narrow alley and then another that bisected the first, the channels between the buildings becoming so narrow that it felt like I could scarcely walk without turning to one side or the other. Suspicion was beginning to creep into my mind. Perhaps the voice was leading me into some kind of trap. Was I a fool for following it deeper and deeper into dark places? The object in my pocket seemed to throb with intensity. Maybe, just maybe, looking at it would help clarify the situation for me. Just as those thoughts crescendoed into a body-shaking horror that I was certain would undo me, the door appeared before me, exactly as I had seen it in my vision. It looked old. The building into which it was laid seemed brand new by comparison, and the old brick structure had to be a few hundred years old. Why then did the door look like it had been here far longer than the rest of the structure? It looked like it would more appropriately be set into the wall of a castle, or perhaps found amidst ruins buried in the woods for thousands of years. The wood gave the impression that a solid kick might turn the whole thing into a pile of splinters, but when I reached out and touched the portal, it felt as firm beneath my fingers as the bricks into which it was set. I grabbed the handle and turned it, but it didn't yield so easily to my grasp. There was no keyhole anywhere on the door that I could see, and the panic started to slip back in. How do I open it? Where does the key go? I tried the handle again, taking it with both hands and trying to force it.
"Calm, Brother Vance. Place both hands on the door and wait."
I did as the voice said, though my hands were shaking as I sat them against the worn wood of the door. I laid my palms flat and waited. The door was cold, as though it had no regard for the relatively warm weather that existed around it. It was cold enough that after a few moments of resting my palms upon it, they started to hurt. I was about to repeat my discomfort so the voice knew what was happening, but as I opened my mouth, I felt a click within the door, as if some unknowable lock had just set its pins.
"Now, open it now, quickly."
I scrambled for the handle, twisting it sharply and pushing at the door. It had to push open because there was no way it could be pulled open in the narrow passage. The door fell wide, and I toppled through it, my stomach swinging freely as I lost balance and cascaded through the opening. I was overcome by a sensation of movement for a moment, as though I'd fallen for much, much further than I could have, and then I was laying on the ground, righting myself. I heard the slam of the door behind me, and I turned quickly to see that, indeed, the door had shut itself in my wake. What I didn't understand was how the door was sitting at an angle above me, apparently lodged in the side of an old tree. The frame was exactly how it had been on the other side, but the position was impossible. I could not have stepped through a door in an alley and walked out of a tree in, well, I wasn't certain where the tree was, but a quick look around me told me I was nowhere near a city. Forest spread out around me as far as I could see in any direction. I couldn't even hear a car or an airplane. Wind rippled through the branches of the trees and I shivered. It was cold in this new place. The trees had cast off their leaves and the taste of snow was in the air. I was ill-dressed for such weather in my light slacks and short-sleeved t-shirt. "Where am I?" I asked, not yet feeling the relief I had hoped to feel upon passing through the door. This place felt strange, if not as tainted as the one I had left.
"So ungrateful, Brother Vance." A voice rose up to my left and I almost fell over my feet, turning to see who it was. Some terrified part of my mind told me it was going to be Father Icarus, that he had followed me all the way to this new place and he was going to be furious. But it wasn't the mad father who faced me. It was something far worse. The voice had spoken of this one. He had eyes as black as the space between stars and colder than the ocean in winter. His smile stretched too far on his face, as though his mouth could open his head in half and he might devour a man whole, though he was no bigger than one himself. Still, large though he might not have been, his presence was vast. He was a beacon of maliciousness that flared like black fire where he stood. "We brought you all the way to this new safe place, and all you do is complain that you're cold and the world is strange. That is behavior most unbecoming of a man of your accomplishments." The uncanny man spoke with a voice plump with false sincerity and one that addressed thoughts I hadn't even given words to. My body shivered, not from the cold, but from facing this nightmare in the flesh. "What accomplishments?" I managed to ask, for I had done nothing but run away. "Why, you've done the most important thing a man can do in service to the worm, Brother Vance. You moved the beacon to a new world." It smiled then, thousands of teeth filling the wretched gap in its face. "You've brought the worm to a new place to feast as a reward. We will let you watch as this new world is consumed." I shook my head. "No, I was just trying to get away."
The dark creature laughed.
"Our heroes are often born of cowardice. It is fear that lets us inside, that empties out a place for us to take root. And Brother Vance, I promise you that we are rooted in the very fabric of who you are. We chose you to carry our prophecy, and then we chose you to carry the beacon. You were our champion from the very first time you woke up sobbing from one of our visitations, and we have feasted on your misery ever since. We drove you right into the hands of Father Icarus, and now his compound is burning with all of the precious flock tucked away inside. You helped to do that, Vance. You should be proud. Their screams burn brighter than the carbon in their bones." Laughter seemed to echo all around us, rising as if from some damned audience, and it was joined by the sounds of people screaming in heart-wrenching agony. I fell to my knees, shaking in horror. The uncanny man shook his head. "Tisk, tisk, Brother Vance. There is no time for sloth. our master hungers. I hope you enjoyed The Voice, as written by Heath Paff and performed by yours truly, Paul J. McSorley. To find more from Heath Paff, please visit simplyscarypodcast.com/Paff, spelled P-F-A-F-F, and you'll be redirected to his author profile on our horror fiction website, creepypastastories.com, where you'll find ways to follow him on his website of foxesmind.com. That's OFFOXSMIND.com, as well as a link to his work on Amazon.com by clicking his Amazon link on that profile. A small portion of your purchase goes to us here at Chilling Tales, where we are proud Amazon affiliates, to help make this show possible. After a failed ambush on a Comanche tribe, the survivors of the attacking cavalry flee and hide in a deep and dark forest. Once deep in the trees, they begin disappearing one at a time, caused by something seemingly not of this world. And now for your indulgence, Omega Forest by Hank Belbin.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Ye needn't think the only folks is the folks hereabouts. H.P. Lovecraft, The Dunwich Horror. Even in this world, more things exist without our knowledge than that with, and the order in creation which you see is that which you have put there. Judge Holden, Blood Meridian. Part 1. New Mexico Territory, 1850. The survivors of the cavalry fled north across the Salt Plains. 10 miles after them, the Comanche retinue pursued. The raid had failed, and now the company were the prey. East was Fort Apache, west was Tijuana, and south lay the fiery furnace of Sonora Desert, endless and white and dead and shimmering under the sun like a boundless sea of glass. North was the only option. They made for Coconino Forest in search of escape and sanctuary. They were all coated in blood and gore, and the black powder from the battle that had carried them wearily across the desert for days now, the ingredients of which sticky against their tattered uniforms like tar. The Comanche savages had pursued the survivors relentlessly since Juarez, and they aimed to finish the job before day's out. 42 of the company's men lay cut down and scalped in the desert wastes some ways back. Now there were only 10 more to see to. The raid was ambushed before any defense could even be mounted. The rattling hail of arrows that had descended onto the unit from the ridge days gone, like an unwelcome rain, had sent the cavalry into pandemonium. Plumes of gray gun smoke then echoed in the valley and had carried off into the winds, and the battle raged, but the shots failed to find their targets. After an hour, those at the back saw that the battle was lost and they were routed. The 10 men, under command of Captain Morton, turned on their heels and stole into the shimmering heat of the desert. None of them looked back to see the finale of the nightmare. Men that they knew well were now laid strewn across the sands behind them. They all screamed as the grotesque carnival of savages butchered and danced their way through the company. But it was not over. Those who had survived and fled across the Salt Plains had merely lived on only to face a new nightmare. Of those men, something far worse awaited them. Of the men who did escape the ambush, there was Morton, the only surviving officer, Corporal, whose Christian name was not known to any man, Jackson, Hughes,
Bill, Lewis, Carson, and Powell. They rode on for days, away from the massacre, all of them fused to their saddles as if they had merged with beasts alike and had become an abstraction of the centaurs before them. It was on the third day that Morton noticed it. Something out there on the prairie behind them, pulsing in the midday heat. On the horizon behind them, a cloud of dust grew. Captain Morton stopped and produced his spyglass and aimed at the cloud. He knew what it was. The Comanche tribe were following them. That much was clear. Morton slammed the spyglass home with the base of his palm and snorted.
"We'll not make camp tonight. We'll leave a fire in the night and ride on," he said. The men about obliged. Much later, after the sun had set, the trick did not work. The Comanche knew that it was a gambit. They had ridden past the decoy fire and pursued the remaining cavalry into the twilight all the same. They had expected the routed to flee south across the border, but they did not. The tired survivors rode their horses hard. They whipped and lashed at their horses' behinds, desperate to break away from the pursuers. The night was long and cold and dark. They rode on. And just after dawn, the survivors then saw looming up towards them the deep and brooding forest. A great wall of silhouettes poised there against the tenebrous blue sky of the early morning sun. They believed their salvation was nigh. Yet, something else was instead. Still behind them was the chief and his tribe. However, suddenly, they had lost all compunction to pursue the survivors. They saw their prey and gasped, each at what the cavalry in front was about to do. "Key!" one of the Comanches shouted. When the 10 survivors came to the fringe of the forest, the Comanche pursuers suddenly halted as if gripped by something. They snatched and tugged at their reins each, and the horses skidded in the dust 800 meters behind the survivors and the tree line. All of the tribe were suddenly commandeered by unassailable fear now. They had been focused on the mission of dispatching the survivors so much that they had not noticed just where they were pursuing them to. The dreaded forest. The motionless Comanche leader watched on as Morton and the 9 other survivors disappeared into the wall of dark trees. One of the savages mumbled some kind of prayer and shut his eyes of the sight. The chief knew that all who went into that forest never came back out again. There was something else in there. Something old. They turned around, panic-stricken, and rode quickly back in the direction they had just come from. Part 2. Deep in the trees, the men teetered and trotted through in silence. They had been riding in it for almost an hour. The decaying forest all around wholly unnatural. Drizzle fell and the trees creaked in the languid breeze. No other sounds apart from the hooves moving through it all. Rows and rows of unmoving pine trees sprawling endlessly before them, bearing down on them. Yet, no sound. They all soon noticed the eerie quiet.
"You hear that?" Bill called out.
"I don't hear nothing," Hughes replied after a pause.
"Exactly. Forest this big and not so much as a bird making noise? Strange."
"Keep it down," Morton then barked. "Could be another ambush."
They moved on down gulches and finally stopped at a trickling, fetid stream to fill their canteens and tend to their wounds. The ride took most of the morning. Lewis had caught an arrow in his arm during the ambush a few days ago, and his shoulder was beginning to fester. His linen shirt was stained brown with pus and blood, and the flies all about swarmed him eagerly. None offered consultation on his injury. Morton knelt down to the water and considered his reflection in the blade of his bowie knife. He looked 10 years older than what he was. As he examined his face in the middle, though, he caught sight of something. Up on the ridge to his left, something moved. Something big. Too big to be Comanche. Morton snapped his gaze left and up at the ridge line at the sight. He had thought he saw something move in his peripheries. He was sure of it. But peering up there now, he saw nothing. Only beams of sunlight slanted through the dead trees and onto him, and there was nothing else up there. He frowned, then resigned himself to the task of filling his canteen and shaving his sideburns. The men about him were solemn and filled with dread, like the attendees of some morbid wake. Morton calculated that any further acknowledgement of anything untoward would only panic the men further. He chose not to mention it to his retinue. Hughes, however, had already seen something. He stood motionless in the river, the water up to his knees. He stared up absently at the same point on the ridge that the captain was looking at. His eyes were wide with terror, and he quivered in his boots.
"Hughes, what you looking at, boy?"
Corporal snapped, noticing his odd behavior. Hughes did not respond. He just kept staring up at the part of the ridge where the sun straddled the earth.
"Hughes, fall in line,"
Captain Morton barked. Hughes came back to reality, the tears still fresh in his eyes. He looked up at Morton on his horse. They shared a glance.
"Yes, sir,"
Hughes said obediently, and shuffled out of the river to collect his personal effects laying on the waxed tarp at the bank. After a small rest, they mounted and rode on. The day was almost out and their pace had slowed to a crawl as they negotiated over mires and small ravines. When night fell, they stopped and made camp up on a ridge that overlooked the boundless mass of dark trees. They could not see the edge of the forest. Captain Morton briefed his men and devised a rota for sentry duty. They made a fire and oriented their sleeping bags around it. All of them huddled around the only warmth like a litter of starved puppies waiting for their mother to return. Jackson had first watch. After taking on some cold coffee, he navigated through the dimness of the forest and stood at a point 50 meters away from the campfire. He then held his rifle loosely and stared off into the brooding night. It was a long shift. Later, after Jackson's sentry duty was over, he was relieved by Lewis, who took up the exact footprints in the dirt that he had made himself. Jackson then came back to his roll mat and bag of particulars and saw that the roll mat next to his own was empty. Powell was not there. Jackson frowned and noted the man's possessions and rifle were still by the fire.
"Where's Powell?" Jackson asked Hughes.
"Gone," Hughes muttered as he spat into the fire. He was sharpening his knife but was not focusing on the task at hand. Instead, he merely rubbed the filthy whetstone up and down the blade with seemingly random motions.
"How long has he been gone?"
"Reckon about 2 hours now. Said he was gone for shit. Ain't came back." Jackson nervously knelt down to Hughes.
"You reckon them Indians followed us in here after all?"
he whispered.
"I reckon they did,"
Hughes said, and his eyes darkened as he stared into the flames.
"There will be blood tonight. I take no sleep. You can be sure of that."
Jackson looked away from Hughes and pondered what he meant by such a statement. All the same, he felt something heavy fall into his chest. Dread. Hughes stared absently into the fire as if taken by something. He would not say what exactly and didn't speak for the rest of the night. Jackson smoked a cigarette and tried to forget about the whole notion. It was almost midnight. The men about the fire snoozed and dreamed of seeing the inside of a saloon again. They fantasized about collecting their wages and buying a hot bath, a bottle of whiskey, and a seat at the poker table. The swollen silver moon hung above them all in the black starless sky like a great primordial egg, or like an augury to their own fates. The fire cracked and smoldered, and no other sounds were heard. Jackson slept and snored softly. Then from somewhere out in the twilight something awoke him. One of the men on sentry screamed, a guttural, agonizing screech that echoed through the night. And then, nothing. The men about the fire bolted up in their sleeping bags and reached for their rifles. Cold fear assailed them all like an arctic wind. An icy shiver clawed its way down Jackson's spine. He felt the color drain from his face as he stared out utterly terrified into the silent night beyond the campfire. Something was out there in the dark.
They all opened their ears to the wilderness but heard nothing. Just silence. None dared to call out for Lewis. Whatever was out there, it had taken him. His screams sounded like choking, then like he was gargling something. Then nothing but the unnerving, widening silence. Jackson's eyes were bulging with terror. He panted and shuddered and tried to take command of his shaking body.
"Some bitch," Carson said. "Something has got Lewis."
"What, a bear?" Jackson asked.
"I reckon. Can't no Indian produce sounds like that from a man. That boy's been snared by jaws of goddamn bear. You heard it on his throat."
"Shut up, Carson. It ain't no bear," Morton shouted. "We got traps all around."
"And what the hell is it?"
Morton stood above the cowering party and shook his head, remembering again what he thought he had seen on that ridge earlier.
"I don't know, but that ain't no fucking bear."
Some of the horses had broken from their hitchings at the sound and had bolted off into the twilight, all frantic and feral like something driven demented with rabies. No one attempted to rein them in. No one dared to leave the fireside. All were too terrified to even think of moving. There was no sleep to be had for the rest of the night. The men all sat up in their bags in a circle. They held their rifles outstretched before them as if like a phalanx, gun barrels probing into the darkness all around. All refused to leave their bags nor the glowing side of the campfire as if both would offer shielding and insulate them from whatever lurked out there beyond the black trees. A juvenile notion that there was safety in the light. Everyone sat motionless on the freezing ground like a huddle of terrified rabbits, and they could only hope for the morning and safety and solidarity. None dared imagine what it was. They prayed to see a band of savages running out of the darkness toward them. There would be no fear attached to that. But deep down, before any explanation had even been offered, they all knew it was something else. Something much worse. Hughes was eerily calm throughout the whole ordeal. He simply stared ahead into the heaving darkness as if awaiting something. Part 3. Dawn finally crawled around. The men shivered in their spots, the metal of their rifles so cold in their palms it was gnawing into their skin. The morning was damp and gray. After first light, the men, all haggard and haunted and pale from the night gone, jumped out of their rolls and packed away their passables. The lines and wrinkles on their grayed and weathered faces even more prominent. No coffee was made. Everyone packed and stuffed their possessions into the saddlebags with quick, skittish movements, looking all around as they did, like birds nervously checking behind them as they fed. Carson remained at the perimeter of the camp on sentry whilst the rest prepared to leave. He fixed his eyes on points in the trees. In the gloom of the dawn, however, the woods all around blurred and merged into shades of mottled brown. It was hard to distinguish anything at all. There was no movement in that teetering dimness. Not even woodland animals could be heard.
"What do you suppose that was last night?" Bill asked the somber group.
"Indians," Hughes replied, lying to himself. "Like I said, they would be." No one else said anything. They saddled up quickly and rode on through miles of tall, swaying trees, checking frequently over their shoulders as they did. Lewis was not found. Only his rifle remained, bent into a U-shape and tossed into the brush 5 meters from his sentry point the night before. They moved as one entity, horse and man, men and horses, all locked into a common alliance of survival, no one being separate from another. A covenant of mutual diligence from both creatures, as if the very nature of Lewis's gruesome disappearance had ignited the primal instincts of being prey, long dormant in both man and beast. The sun was low and white, and the rays barely filtered through the branches onto them. After another hour, they came to a small creek, then a valley. And further down that valley, they found Lewis. He had been disemboweled and dismembered, and his head sat in the cavity of his own chest.
his dull fish eyes now frozen in their sockets like two orbs of jelly staring up absently at the clouded gray sky beyond the canopy of trees. Flies buzzed around his desecrated body, and the stench was unbearable for the men. Morton gagged and spat from the side of his horse. The men gawked and stared silently at Lewis's corpse, all too stunned and horrified to speak. They rode on, and no eulogies were said. No one dared to speculate what manner of living thing existed on this earth that could do that to another. It was late in the afternoon the next day. The men were tired beyond saving. No sleep was had, and they remained unfed. The horses scuttled through the underbrush wearily as if being led through it all in a trance. The tall grass tickled their underbellies as they stepped and scrabbled over the terrain. The men moved forward, and still, the force kept coming forward back at them. No matter how far they all moved, it seemed there was no edge to the trees. Hughes, at the back of the party, swayed from side to side in his saddle. His eyes rolled around in their sockets, and he could not focus on the ride anymore. He was so tired and delirious that he had noticed the party were no longer in front of him, and he had been riding off in the opposite direction for a long time. He could only recall the horrific sight of Lewis back there in the valley. He had never told anyone what he saw up there on that ridge, but he knew it in his heart that it had done that to Lewis. The shadow that walked and made mockery of the man's body, and Hughes wondered who of the party would be next. It was only after another 10 minutes that the party all noticed he was no longer with them. Morton had called for Hughes to come to his side for assistance with the compass, but when there was no response, they all looked over their shoulders for the first time in a while and saw that he was gone. "Hughes!" Morton bellowed into the trees but was met with no response. Morton then turned to his second in command. "Corporal, he's falling behind. Go get him," Captain Morton shouted. Corporal sat on top of his horse near the front of the party like he had received a final summons. The prospect of riding back alone turned his stomach. He quivered in his saddle and merely looked back at Captain Morton with doe eyes, like a child. "Did you not hear me?" Morton snapped. "I heard you just fine, but I'll not do it," he said as his horse tottered underneath him. Morton glared at Corporal with blistering red eyes. "He has a second compass. Do it," he snarled. "Can't no man compel another to tasks he ain't equipped for." "A high-ranking man can, and you are equipped for it. In the confines of a regular scenario, I reckon so. But this ain't no regular scenario, sir. I'll not do it. There's something. You will, or I will shoot you." Morton soon produced his Colt revolver and pointed it at Corporal. The party froze in anticipation. Corporal squirmed, but only for a moment. "Then shoot me, goddammit, and I'll be shut of this," Corporal snarled. "Better than the fate out yonder them trees. You saw what they did to his body. But consider this. You'll have one less soul watching your back if and you do shoot me dead now. You reckon you can make it out these woods alive on your lonesome?" Morton locked eyes with Corporal and both stared at each other menacingly. Corporal had begun to slowly reach for his cattleman revolver, the hand movements slow like a snake's. Morton watched. All about the pair expected blood, but the fight never came to fruition. Morton considered, then slid the hammer up and holstered his revolver once more. "Bill, you go back and bring him back here," Morton instead said over his shoulder to Bill. Jackson's eyes vacillated between Corporal, Morton, and Bill. Bill nodded obediently and turned and rode back into the twisted mess of branches and bark. The unit then all watched him silently as his form dwindled against the bleakness of that raw mass of ancient wood. "That ain't Indians out there. That's something else," Corporal muttered to himself. Jackson pretended he had not heard it.
Later in the day, and neither Bill nor Hughes returned. After an hour waiting, Morton decided that they were not coming back, and they rode on. Night fell with practiced bravado. The overcast lowering clouds smothered and sucked all warmth and comfort from both earth and man. They made camp near a large boulder, and the night was long and uneventful. They sat around the fire, and each man stared into the flames, each man seeing something unique in the effulgence, as if the flames themselves were extensions of man's hubris unto the world, burning in all directions without a moment's consideration on where to go next. In the morning, they rose and saddled up and dispatched without admin. The day was long and monotonous, and Jackson began to wonder if they were merely going in circles. He had sworn he had seen that same fallen tree before, and that same trickling stream. Time moved forward without definition, but then... 5 miles north on a fallen tree, the unit soon found the severed heads of their lost men. Bill, who had ridden ahead to investigate Hughes' disappearance, Powell, who had disappeared the night previous, and Hughes himself, who had fallen behind. All three bloodied heads now sat on the moss-covered tree trunk in front of Morton like some gawky exhibition. He looked down from his horse at the carnival scene and recognized nothing of the men he once knew from his unit. They were gone, and the husks they had left behind held nothing anymore. They looked to him like a row of coconuts that one would throw rocks at. A fairground game that people would laugh at. The hacked-off heads nothing more than a pantomime of gore. Bill's lifeless eye looked up at Morton from there on the tree with an absence that could only now be acknowledged as existence. He once was, and now he was no more. His grayed head perched on the tree trunk with one eye shut and the other, lazily, vacantly, looking up at his captain. Paul had no jaw, and instead, his head sat on the bark like some grotesque ornament. His face festooned with dried black blood. He had no eyes. They had been scooped out and replaced with dried grass.
What the hell done that?
Carson mewed. Indians, Morton said, and no one believed him.
They ain't no Indians doing. Them faces got bite marks on them. You sent Bill off like that, Cap'n.
Quiet, Morton then shouted, and Carson did. Morton sighed deeply and shut his eyes to regain some semblance of composure. They rode on in silence. They were down to four men now. Corporal, Carson, Captain Morton, and Jackson. Later, they found a small river at the base of the valley and set up camp next to it. Corporal sat in the dirt, his knees pulled up to his chest. He stared vacantly into the rolling flames of the campfire as each man about him did also. Morton watched him from the other side of the yellow blades of fire. Jackson smoked his last cigarette.
Hugh saw it, didn't he?
Corporal asked Jackson in a low, defeated voice. I mean, whatever it is out there.
I reckon.
You got a woman? He then asked strangely.
No. Ever been with one?
A whore.
Where?
El Paso.
I have a wife, Dolores. She's waiting for me.
Jackson flicked the butt of his cigarette into the fire and struggled to find the right words.
I'll not wait here any longer for judgment,
Corporal said after 5 minutes.
I'm leaving tonight, one ways or another.
You go it alone and you die,
Jackson replied.
I'd take my chances. We're as good as dead sitting here anyhow. Whatever that is out there, it ain't of this world. It's hunting us. There are things abroad out here, and I'll have no part of them.
With that, Corporal rose silently and unhitched his horse and rode off into the darkness without so much as a word passed. Captain Morton sucked on his pipe and watched him leave and said nothing also. Jackson watched the behind of the horse and Corporal alike steal away into the wall of inky black. Corporal was never seen again. With the departure, the three survivors then fell in on themselves, the crushing gloom and their souls heavy against their bodies like chains of bondage.
The fire smoldered, and no man rose to furnish it with more wood. All were too taken with the plight to think of anything else. The remaining three horses had escaped at some point in the small hours of the night. They had chewed through their bindings and took solace in escape, seemingly seeing more promising refuge in the smothering black out there. The next day, the men rose, all gray and sullen and beaten. They saw that the horses were gone and could not afford any more than a grunt and a sigh at their passage. They packed their things and walked north. The day was arduous, and it carried with it the sense of guilt or some abstraction of survivor's guilt therein. Why, when all the others had fallen, did these three stand? The remaining three then made camp at nightfall with what provisions they had carried with them. They did not eat and instead installed themselves in their bags, all facing outward. They sat and waited and dreamed of home. The night was heavy and vibrating, was full of strange rustlings. Beyond the meager glow of the campfire, something was moving around quietly out there. Something big and heavy, but stealthy and taciturn. It was coming closer. Twigs snapped and the earth squirmed under something. All of them heard it, but they refused to acknowledge it just the same. They prayed it was wolves out there on the perimeter, but it was not. The fire died later, and only the oil lamp illuminated the cold, dark floor of the forest about, a small island of light against a sea of black. They sat, waiting on guard, ready for any advance. It was much further into the night when Jackson's eyelids finally began to sag. He hadn't slept in almost 3 days, and he could not fight it any longer. At some point, he didn't know when, his head slumped forward, and he leaned down into his chest. The rifle fell against his head but went unacknowledged. Then he closed his eyes and everything went quiet. He awoke later only to hear the shrill screaming of Carson assaulting his ears. There was this savage, jarring scream that filtered through the trees and had awoken him from his sleep.
"Help!" Carson shouted. "It's got me! Please! Help!"
He shouted as he was dragged off into blackness. Jackson bolted up from his slumber and looked around, the spit in his mouth clumpy and salty. His eyes were swollen shut still with the task of sleep. Jackson looked to his left. On the ground where Carson was sitting, not moments earlier, were now drag marks leading off into the grass. There were claw marks also, and clumps of underbrush had been ripped from their roots by something. Carson shrieked somewhere back in the forest.
"God damn!"
Jackson gasped in horror. He instinctively reached for his rifle and stood up in the gloom.
"What the hell is this?"
Carson's dwindling screams then slithered off into nothingness, and his gut-wrenching cries of despair soon vanished. And both Jackson and Morton stood up from their bags and positioned themselves back-to-back next to the oil lamp, both rifles facing out. Neither one of them saw what took Carson.
"Holy Jesus, what is it?"
Jackson asked. "I don't know," Morton replied. "I really don't know." His voice was cracking. The forest was silent again, and the pair stood by the hollow glow of the lamplight with all the loneliness and dread in the world bearing down on them, both men awaiting their turn. Minutes went by like hours, and Jackson probed into the pit of his stomach in search of a warmth he might have called hope. The only reassurance he felt was Morton's bulky back pressed against his own. The last two tethered together in an uneasy partnership of survival.
"He's gonna come back,"
Jackson said. "I know.
It's gonna take us next."
They stood together like two stalagmites, soldered down to the primal earth below their boots. They waited, and there was nothing. Minutes went by.
"How long you calculate till dawn?"
Jackson whispered to Morton after another few minutes, but there was no reply.
"Sir?"
Jackson asked. He turned around and saw that Morton was gone.
"Sir?"
he asked once more. Dropping his gaze to the floor, he saw what remained.
On the ground by Jackson's feet was a bloodied rifle and Morton's cavalry hat, all ripped up.
"My God!"
he said as he stared down at all that was left of his captain. Without even thinking, Jackson turned and ran. He snatched up the oil lamp and panted and screamed as he lurched forward through the woods, away from the scene, away from it all. He ran and ran. Then, without prelude, he smacked his head on a low-hanging branch and fell into the mud. His body dropped into the mire, and he laid there for paws. His hearing rang like someone was firing an Evans repeater right next to his head. Tingling, nauseating noise that sounded like iron pots being kicked down the stairs. When he came around again, he sat up blearily in the dirt, and he heard it. Something was coming toward him, lumbering heavy footsteps squelching through the marsh. Jackson cautiously stood up. The noise had brought him back to reality, and he took hold of himself once more. He was trembling. He could barely keep a grip on his rifle. He retreated two steps and found his back against a tree, the rough bark prodding through his thin blazer. His eyes darted in all directions, squinting into the shroud, trying to spy the origin of the low steps stalking ever closer to him. He looked right and saw nothing. He looked left and saw only unending blackness. Then he peered forward once more and saw it. He gasped, and the rifle fell from his suddenly weakened grip. There in front of him was a giant shadow, this immense black gargoyle that seemed not to have form nor aspect, just this mass of wet, reeking fur. It had protrusions and antlers spouting from every angle on its behemoth-like body that moved around like driftwood caught in a tide. It came closer and leaned down to Jackson. He whimpered. His lips quivered and a tear rolled down his blistered face.
"Please, have mercy,"
he tried to say, but his voice shook too much for the words to be distinguished. The breath of the beast was hot and wet and rancid on his face. It smelt like rotting flesh, copper, and stagnant lake water. Its giant damn snout inches from his own. It snorted and steaming strings of saliva hit his face. He held the oil lamp up in the darkness and saw only a massive, slimy, and hairy mouth in front of him, all the dripping red gore clinging to its flat, square teeth. He screamed, but not for long. It was cut short by the towering, goatish beast before him. Back at the Comanche camp, the chief snapped up from a horrific nightmare. Cold sweat rolled down his face, and he puffed and panted. Somewhere deep in his dreams, he had seen that all of the survivors who had gone into that forest were now dead. But it was what would happen to them after death that made the chief feel utterly terrified. Their souls would never find rest, and he knew that. His wife reached up to console him, but it was not warranted. He pushed her away and stared forward at the opening in the teepee, past it and out into that ever-expanding blackness of night. Out there, he knew the thing still lingered. He did not see the face that killed them all, nor hear its movements in his nightmare, but only knew its presence as an ancient and evil spirit. It had no name, and he knew those men would not be the last to perish in that forest because of it. Hope you enjoyed tonight's tale, Omega Forest, by Hank Belbin. Hank Belbin is a horror author and screenwriter from Southampton, England. Primarily focusing on cosmic horror, Hank has had several short stories published on online magazines and is working on publishing his second novel set in Dartmoor, England. He has published two full-length plays that have been successful runs at Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and also published a literary fiction novel called Moonland. The story is about a struggling actor living in London who falls in with drugs and kidnapping. For more details, go to www.hankbelbin.com. That's HankBelbin.com.
If you enjoyed tonight's story, hosted by yours truly, Paul J. McSorley, you can search my name on Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on YouTube for additional previous stories. If you'd like to hear more lengthy tales, be sure to take a look at my audiobooks. Available now on audible.com or just visit paulsbooks.net. That's paulsbooks.net. You can also find me personally on Facebook and Twitter. And with that, listeners, our weekly journey into the psyche has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight's episode and remind you to take a moment to stop by our iTunes page and leave Chilling Tales for Dark Nights a 5-star review and a kind word. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram if you haven't already. And of course, subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can find an archive of our work going back to 2012. And consider signing up as a patron at our website, chillingtalesfordarknights.com, to show your support and get all of our content ad-free. I'm your host for Fear from the Heartland, Paul J. McSorley. I've enjoyed the titillation tonight. Ooh, there's that word again. Thank you for joining me. Hope to see you again next week at Fear from the Heartland.
Redick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.